welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, sitting in today for Carl Gerke. And Mark Tilson is the co-founder of Native American Natural Foods, the company that makes the Tonka Bar. The energy bars are made of buffalo meat and available in stores around the country. Native American Natural Foods is headquartered in the town of Kyle on Pine Ridge, and the company's vision includes staying in Pine Ridge to help create jobs and improve economic development overall. This spring, Tilson was invited to speak before a congressional committee in Washington, D.C. on the challenges of creating economic development in the United States. SDPB's Charles Michael Ray caught up with Tilson right after he got back from D.C. and spoke with him about these issues.
Mark Tilson, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You just got back from Capitol Hill. We're sitting here in Rapid City. You spent time there in front of Congress talking about your business, Native American Natural Foods, and some bigger picture items as well, talking a little bit about the new farm bill even and how this all ties together. Can you put your testimony sort of in a nutshell for us?
Yeah, I was invited by Senator Thune, who sits on Senator Heidi Heitkamp's Committee on USDA Rural Economies and I think it's energy innovation. And she held hearings to talk about regional planning, and she wanted to hear the story of the Tonka Bar brand and how we created the brand in on the Pine Ridge Reservation and how that brand fits in with rural regional economies. And it was a fun experience to be able to testify before Senate and be on a panel with some of the top experts in rural economic development and listen and learn from them and then listen to what the senator's concerns are. And I think, you know, Senator Heitkamp's really trying to lead a new vision for rural economic development. I was pretty impressed listening to her.
And when we talk about rural economic development, the Farm Bill is a big deal. It's a big part of that. And a lot of that rulemaking is still getting worked out for what the Farm Bill is going to mean for rural economic development. Is that right?
It's interesting. I think every 10 years we create a farm bill, and it takes 4 to 5 years to roll the whole bill out because it's such a massive bill and has, you know, complicated impacts. And here in rural communities, our state office and regional offices of USDA, the Office of Community Development, play critical roles in terms of financing infrastructure in Indian Country. And we're kind of stuck in a situation of USDA is doing more than any other agency in the area of economic development, and it isn't even close to enough to deal with the facts that we have some basic demographic changes in Indian Country that separate Indian Country from other rural counties. And we talked about at the hearing that on Pine Ridge and across in South Dakota, we have 11 of the poorest counties in the United States. But the other thing is that those counties are growing in population. A lot of people know that the Pine Ridge community, with the leadership of Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation and the Oglala Sioux Tribe, passed a sustainability plan called the Omichia Plan. That plan shows that pretty much every community on the Pine Ridge Reservation is at capacity when you examine their infrastructure of water, sewer, sanitation, high-speed internet, telephone, electricity. They're already at capacity, but these are the fastest-growing counties in the state. And so the question that I ask the senators is that, looking at the fact that the average age on the reservation is under 24 years old, we have to start looking at the growth in Indian Country as an opportunity, not a problem. And we have to start making investments commensurate with the opportunity. Otherwise, we're kind of stuck into this old pattern of building more jails and prisons and law enforcement and treatment facilities because we're not creating the opportunity for – we're not creating the climate for opportunity. And the reservation are full of young, creative people that have hopes and dreams and want to do things, and great organizations that are working really, really hard from, you know, all the way to the new Lakota immersion programs that you're seeing at Head Start to innovations going on in the grade school, high school, and, you know, led by the tribal colleges like Oglala Lakota College. And then the many community organizations and our local CDFIs, just look at the growth of Lakota Fund, and they've built a credit union. In every reservation, we're seeing all this success, but the success is getting frustrated by the lack of resources that doesn't come close to meeting the commensurate of the problem. The folks who testified at the hearing talked about the brain drain and the outflow going from rural communities and how they were trying to work on attracting people back. Indian communities, through their tribalism, through their connection, through their history of connecting to the land and to each other, those communities are growing. But like on Pine Ridge, it's estimated that we're short between 4,000 and 5,000 houses. 4,000 and 5,000 houses. And I think current funding is around 120 to 130 houses. So we're barely building enough houses to keep up with the growth in population. So we're not really addressing the problem. There's hope that with this new farm bill and this new sort of open way of looking at it, that we really need to address the fact that South Dakota, in my opinion, really kind of has a form of economic apartheid. You know, and I said that in front of the Senate because we have really fast growing urban centers that, you know, national press talks about what the great business climate is in South Dakota and how there's a shortage of skilled labor and all that. And we don't mention the fact that we have these counties where the unemployment rate has never been better than 65%. And somehow we're comfortable as a business community, as a state, saying that, you know, we're comfortable having these two forms of economic systems where one is locked in a permanent set of poverty, even while the other is thriving. And I think that, you know, and that's because we lack the political courage to make the necessary investments in that are commensurate with this growth. And it's really time we change our thinking and start looking at the growth in Indian country as opportunity. And that's kind of what we're trying to do with Native American Natural Foods. As we've built the Tonka brand, we're now sold in, I think we passed 6,000 stores now in every state in the nation. We've created 9 permanent jobs on the reservation, and we're trying to grow that. But we're also in the process of converting our company to where our employees are beginning to own what they're building so that over time more they'll own more of it, with the idea that these kinds of companies that are what we call social enterprises are designed to be assets to the community that will be there to break the economic isolation of the reservation for generations to come. We also talked about the fact that while there's a lot of growth in the buffalo industry in South Dakota, there's very limited access for new, young, native people who want to get in to raising buffalo. The capital requirement, the infrastructure requirement has created barriers. And one of the things we've done at Native American Natural Foods is we've launched a new project with one of our partners. We're in partnership with the American Indian Land Tenured Stewardship Foundation, which is an investor of ours, and we've launched the Tonka Fund. And starting in November of 2014, we'll be launching our first annual Tonka Returns Month to raise money and awareness to try to develop some non-federal dollars that could then be used to leverage and help more young people who want to get into buffalo or people who are already into buffalo but lack access to capital. And, you know, as we've grown, we've created a demand for more buffalo, but we're not able to buy enough from native producers. So now we've created an economic opportunity, but we still have to create some models of capital or some access to capital for folks to be able to enter that. So it was a fun time. We got to talk about a pretty broad-ranging amount of stuff. It's always a concern to me, you know, in the politics of Washington, D.C., whether the needs of real people actually can get addressed. But I didn't want to pass up the opportunity to share our story. And, you know, I appreciated the invitation from Senator Thune to be able to go in there and really talk about these issues with the senators. And I'm hopeful that, you know, there might be somebody in there that was doing some listening that could help take this to the next level.
I want to ask, there is a notion in parts of South Dakota that folks who are in poverty are in poverty because of their individual choices and because they're lazy or they choose to be in poverty. And there are those who say, well, we shouldn't give any more government handouts to places that are in poverty. But it sounds to me like you're not talking about government handouts. You're talking about sewer, water, roads, infrastructure. These kind of same things that we all take for granted. If you want to have business development in any city, you just assume, you just call the thing and your water comes, you know, when your water comes on. Is this accurate? You're just saying the kind of investment that should be made in Indian country is the same kind of investment and infrastructure you have access to in Rapid City or elsewhere in Sioux Falls. Or am I oversimplifying this?
Well, to back up to the beginning of your question, blaming the poor for being poor is kind of the original cop-out. I mean, so you can say that, well, we have these poorest counties in South Dakota because Indian people don't want to work. And you can ignore the fact that when we made the compromise to create Indian reservations, we put them on the least productive land, and then we created a local government infrastructure of tribal governments that requires the federal government to manage all affairs of the local government, and then we blame the local government for not being able to succeed. And there's a long history of kind of old-school economic development where we subsidized labor and we subsidized capital, i.e. we gave welfare to big corporations to move their jobs onto the reservation. And you know what? They stayed as long as those subsidies existed. Well, this new form that is in the Farm Bill and that people are talking about is sort of referred to as place-based economic development. And so now we have a chance to look at the assets of the community, like we've done at Native American Natural Foods, the assets of traditional healthy food, the assets of incredible culture, pristine land, the connection between the Lakota people of the buffalo, turn that into a brand and sell it nationally. And now we're trying to drive the impact of that back down. What's been shown is that every single time Indian people have been given an opportunity, they've exploited the opportunity the best they could. But it's often stifled by the federal government. And in the past, our state has spent a lot of money thinking that it's a benefit to the state to keep suing the tribes over different jurisdictional issues, as if having weak local government is somehow an asset to the state, when nobody would make an argument that having weak county government is an asset to the state. So why? And we have to remember that that tribal members are also state citizens. And, you know, they're citizens of their tribe, they're citizens of the state, and they're citizens of the United States government, and they have all the rights of all the other citizens. There is very few economic development that happens here in Rapid City or anywhere that doesn't involve some sort of federal government subsidy or help. And that's true with some of our booming industries, i.e. corn. What percentage of Rapid City's economy is based on the military subsidies that we get in this town? Or the research subsidies. I mean, South Dakota has a lot of people on welfare and a lot more than Indians. And Indian people don't want to be on welfare. They're very entrepreneurial all the way from the artists to the tribal government. But the amount of resources to actually take that to the next level is very, very complicated. And because of the trust land status, that land's not taxable. So it's not always practical to say you're going to fund a water treatment facility or a community plan using a tax base that doesn't exist yet. So these are strategies that everybody's trying to work together to overcome. And the argument I was making to USDA is that we really need to look at this growth in Indian country as an opportunity to get beyond this sort of petty argument of government aid, because there's a lot of government aid involved here. And some of these government aids, you know, the tribal leaders have been and will continue to make the argument that these are treaty obligations. These are moral, ethical, legal obligations that we have. So it's not just okay to say, well, we know that the problem in housing is 4,000 or 5,000 houses, but we're going to fund 125 of them. You know, we have to and then say, well, how come housing's not succeeding? We have to really, you know, take a step back and say, yeah, the problem, you know, of housing on Pine Ridge might be $1 billion. Well, let's fix it, because in the overall scheme of things, that will actually create more economic opportunity and more benefits. And actually, I believe that by investing in young people in their hopes and dreams. And I think, you know, all around the world, statistics will show you that increased investment now is going to actually decrease the investment on these transfer funds you're talking about down the road. So it would actually, you know, increasing now is, I can't quote the exact statistic, but I know that every time you invest in Head Start, you're actually lowering the social cost of poverty. And we need to increase this investment in young people in order to, you know, both morally, ethically, and it does save the, it will save the federal government money over the long term.
I know one of the things you're looking at in your company is availability of the resources you need to produce the products you put out. The Tonka bar is made out of buffalo, and so you need buffalo to keep that going. But finding Native Americans who grow buffalo is harder and harder, especially as your demand increases. Yet there's all these young people in Indian country who are up and coming, who many of whom I'm sure would like to raise buffalo. So is this part of the opportunities you're seeing out there and finding ways to make sure those young people who want to raise buffalo can? I mean, is that just one example of what you're talking about?
Exactly. I mean, the tribal governments have been very successful in returning the buffalo back into the community. But what we're talking about here is that either a ranching family that's currently raising cattle that wants to convert to buffalo, or somebody who is brand new to ranching who aspirationally wants to do this. If you don't have current equity, there's nowhere to access. You might even own your own land, but you don't have a way to access it without capital or technical assistance. So what we're trying to figure out with Lakota, with the Tonka Fund, and we're just getting started with it, is first of all how to raise some money, how to stimulate some interest, so that we can sit down on the local level and help people solve this problem. It's obvious that the investment in buffalo, especially in private herd development, is nowhere close to what it needs to be to participate in this really fast growing industry. And one of the exciting things is Rapid City is kind of the epicenter of the commercial buffalo world. You know, we have two commercial processors here in town. You know, there's a lot of great people involved in the buffalo industry, but there's also great opportunity for more people to participate. And so we're trying to figure that out.
When you talk about place-based economic development, is that a type of development that's more sustainable? Is that something that can last longer and be set up to be good for the long term future, seven generations, say?
Well, I think it's obvious. Like when we're talking about buffalo, is, you know, the buffalo are part of the ecosystem of the Great Plains. They're part of how food was naturally raised here, and you know, if you've had a chance to walk through any of the prairies that have only had buffalo on them the last 25 years, you can see, without even being a biologist, the biodiversity of the plants, the ability of the prairie to come back. And it's obvious that, you know, buffalo are part of this ecosystem. And so the idea behind place-based economic development is to really look at your assets and how do you protect them and how do you plan for the future. And now that we're in a situation where we all have to, in business and in community planning, we have to take into account climate mitigation. Climate change is real. It's happening. We live in an arid state, so the decisions we make about how we use our air, water, land, they're all connected. Native American Natural Foods wanting to grow buffalo and expand our industry is not unconnected from the tribes wanting to stop uranium mining from threatening the water supply in the Black Hills, or the fact that rural communities across our state are becoming more and more unified in opposition to dividing our state with another oil pipeline. As more and more communities are recognizing the threat to this, and what I'm saying is, as social business leaders, as people who believe in sustainable development and job creation, that we can create opportunity and we can create jobs in a sustainable manner. We need to change this argument away from being pro-development versus anti-development to being pro-sustainable, and we need to really make this economic shift. And, you know, we might just be talking about a few acres on Pine Ridge, but then when you read the UN's Commission on Climate Change, they, you know, wrote this 33-page letter to the world leaders saying, right now, the decisions have to be made now, And when I think about the impact of those decisions on my grandchildren and their children, you know, you got to help. You can't help but be in solidarity with the folks who have already set up camps, you know, on Rosebud and up on Cheyenne River and other places to resist this pipeline. You have to be in solidarity with them because our world leaders aren't paying attention. And this isn't, I really, you know, once you read that UN report, I don't even see how intelligent people can debate the fact anymore. When you know, the top scientists in the world, the people who are living out on the land see the change. You know, the only debate is how to help our political leaders get the courage they need to make these changes. And I think it's that urgent. I think these changes, and I think the UN has spelled it out, and I think it's time that we have to make it. And each of us in business are going to have to adjust our business practice in order to be more sustainable.
Mark Tilson, thank you so much for joining us.
It's good to be here again. I've always appreciated the chance to visit with folks on South Dakota Public Radio.
Mark Tilson is the co-founder of Native American Natural Foods. He spoke recently with SDPB's Charles Michael Ray.